Pope is the thing with feathers.
Pope is the thing with feathers.
That's like a bird.
Like a bird.
That perches in the soul.
That perches in the soul. Welcome to the Thing with Feathers podcast, a podcast about birds and hope. I'm your host, birding enthusiast, Courtney Ellis. Welcome back to the Thing with Feathers podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Ellis. We are starting the new year off with a bang here in our studio today. We have Sarah Sanderson. Sarah L. Sanderson is the author of The Place We Make, Breaking the Legacy of Legalized Hate. She admits that she is not fully a birder, but she is married to someone who has been making her look at birds for 22 years. Sarah, what is it like to be birding adjacent?
You know, it's a great thing to be, to have your world expanded in a new way, right? Spouses do that for us. My husband is also a jazz musician, so he's constantly stopping the recording and saying, listen to this, did you hear that? And I'm like, I don't know, like the noise came into my ears, but I don't know if I heard what you wanted me to hear. So same with birds, like he's constantly pointing at birds and saying, is that an osprey or a hawk? And I'm like, I don't know, I'm sorry, you know, but it's wonderful. I have now learned at least what ospreys and hawks generally look like, and I'm able to see their little heads, you know, when he points at the tree and says, there's one in a nest right there. For a long time, I couldn't even see anything at all. But now I can see the movement. So we're making progress.
There's a gift. There's a gift there.
It is for sure.
I think so much of loving someone, whether it's a spouse or a friend or a child, is delighting in what they delight in, even if it's not your thing, which is a skill.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I am beginning to find birds delightful. It's just not where I began. So, yeah.
This is what we love to hear. I tell people, don't say I'm not a birder. Just say I'm not a birder yet. If you live long enough, birding comes to us all.
It will come to you.
And you live in the Pacific Northwest, and that's what your book is about. And we're going to move to that in a moment. But you've been birding in Cameroon. What are the birds like in the rainforest of Cameroon?
Well, you know, it's a totally different world, right? I mean, yes, I live a few blocks from the Clackamas River, which I talk about in my book, and we have bald eagles who nest just like right over here, a couple blocks away. And it's right now, it's cold and gray and rainy here. But we got to go to Cameroon a couple summers ago, and we got to take a canoe trip into the rainforest. And just the whole forest was alive with birds and bugs and vines. And, you know, I can't tell you what any of the things were called, but they were there. And my son in particular, I have a 16-year-old who's very into plants and animals. And he said, Mom, this is the best day of my life. So it was wonderful to be there.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I think that's one of the gifts of social media is I'm not going to make it to Cameroon anytime soon, but I follow birders in Cameroon and Rwanda and China. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the gifts of being able to experience, even in a tiny way, the color and the life and the flora and fauna. Yeah. It's tremendous. For all the bad things social media does to us and for us, there are some gifts.
Well, and then if you ever do go there, you'll say, it looks just like it does in the pictures, right?
But there were fewer mosquitoes when I was looking at it in my living room on my sofa.
That's right. A little muggier now.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, I cannot say enough good things about your beautiful book. So you've taken this historical account of a man named Jacob Vanderpool, and you've also woven in your own story. And I would love you just to start at the beginning. Who is Jacob Vanderpool? Why is he important not only to the history of Oregon, but also to the U.S. history in general?
Yeah. So in 1851 in Oregon City, which was the end of the Oregon Trail, so it was where all of the pioneers in their covered wagons were going, where they could sign up for their free 160 acres of land. And in that place at that time, many people do not know that they had passed a law saying that they only wanted white people to live there. So Oregon was the only state to join the Union with an anti-Black exclusion law on the books. And Jacob Vanderpool, although that law had an effect on innumerable people who just simply didn't come because they knew the law existed, Jacob Vanderpool was the only person who was ever actually tried, convicted and forced to leave Oregon because of that law. So he was a biracial boarding house operator in Oregon City in 1851, and they had a trial. And they kicked him out. So, important to the history of Oregon. Also, I would say that he was the only person in the history of the United States ever to be tried and convicted and punished simply legally for being black. Of course, people are, you know, prosecuted for driving while black or shopping while black or any number of things, but there's usually another legal piece tied to it. And this was simply the law only said, you simply can't be black and be here. So I found out about 6 years ago that, first of all, I found out about his story. And then I found out that two of the people who were connected to the case were related to me. Mm. And so that's when I started to investigate. Mm.
And this realization unfolds throughout the book that this is not only the story of Oregon, the story of the U.S., this is my story. And folks, mm-hmm. you know, this is an audio podcast. You can't see us. I'm a white lady. Sarah is a white lady. And much mm-hmm. of this book is this unfolding realization, not in a look at me sort of way, but in a, okay, this is my story too. What does that mean for me, for my family, for my responsibility to make things right in any way that I can, to tell this story? 90% of the proceeds of your book do not go to you. Tell us a little bit about that. Where does the money for the book go?
Yeah. So I wanted to choose five charities. I mean, first of all, I just knew I couldn't keep the money. I mean, I'm writing about my ancestors' enslaved human beings, that money, while it hasn't been directly, you know, I never got a check that said, this is your slave money. But the socioeconomic capital that has been sort of passed down through the generations, you know, the fact that I was able to go to college and all these things, I've benefited from that. And so I knew that I could not write this story where I'm trying to repent or begin to understand how to repent and then just like take the money to the bank. So I wanted to find some charities, and it ended up to be five that hit on some different aspects of the book. So Equal Justice Initiative, which is about helping people with legal situations. I'm gonna open my copy of the book so I don't forget anybody.
Little cheat sheet.
Yes. Oregon Black Pioneers, which gets at the history of, as the name says, Black Pioneers in Oregon. The Creed Collective, which is my attempt to work in the church angle. I talk about my faith and the fact that some of the people who were part of the case were part of the church also. And so the Creed Collective is a group of Black and Brown churches. The Red Door Project, which is a really fascinating theater experience that provides police officers with a new way of thinking about police encounters with Black and Brown people. And then the Native American Youth and Family Center of Portland. I realized as I was writing the book, I thought it was just going to be about Jacob Vanderpool, but I realized I can't tell this story without also talking about the people who were here before any of the rest of these people got here. So I wanted to give something back to that community as well. So, yeah.
It was a beautiful way to start the book, reading that, you know, this is a story that has shaped you, and you are choosing to give back with the sales of this book. So tell us how your story dovetailed with Jacob Vanderpool's story. One of the things I appreciated most was you write very honestly about many times you've put your foot in your mouth, many times you have said the wrong thing, but it's never fall on the floor in despair, give up. It's like, okay, I can learn from this. I can keep trying. Mm-hmm. And I think in so many conversations around race, it's so tempting to not even try because we're going to say the wrong thing. And then we're going to say the wrong thing again. And we're going to mm-hmm. hurt people without intending to, and we're going to be careless. And you, in the unfolding of this story, realize that you can't just stop. Like, you have to keep pursuing this, even though it's painful, even though sometimes it's embarrassing, even though sometimes, you know, that you'd rather do something else, like this story is your story. So how does your story and your family's story connect to the story of Jacob Vanderpool, and what made you keep going?
Yeah, there have been a lot of missteps. And I think the reason that I felt compelled to lay them all out on the page was that I had this sense that as white people in America, we just mostly don't know how to talk about those things, right? And so you end up with this collection of shameful moments that you keep to yourself. I mean, I did a book group in my church where we read the book together. And one of the women in the very first meeting, she said, "When I was 4 years old, I saw a black person and I said, 'Look, mom, he's black.' And I'm so embarrassed." And it was like, this woman is 40 years old and she's been holding on to this since she was four. And it was so shameful for her to even bring this story to us. And it was like, you were 4 years old. Like, that is going to happen. And
I have a five-year-old. They say a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And, you know, not that everything that comes out of white people's mouth is just this innocent four-year-old like thing that needs to be just excused. But that feeling of carrying the shame throughout your whole life and never having a space to unpack it. That was what I had felt. And so I wanted to, my hope is that in unpacking some of those things on the page, that other white readers who haven't had a space to look at those things can do their own unpacking. And again, I want to be really clear, like it's not to make ourselves feel better about these, you know, maybe it's a microaggression or maybe it's a moment of implicit bias or maybe it's real, you know, it's racism or white supremacy. I mean, these are not things that need to be excused. But if we can't talk about them, I don't think we can begin to heal from them. And so my hope is that in kind of leading with my own collection of shameful moments, that we can begin to talk about these things that we haven't necessarily been so good at talking about before. Mm.
You do that really well and really courageously. I think of the scene on, it's on page 102, where you're kind of coming to terms with some of this pain in the presence of a friend who's black. And you kind of go on about, you know, I don't even know, I'm centering myself, but I should be focusing and repairing the harms that, and I guess I'm afraid. And you know, you kind of go on this little rant, and you look up and this woman, Shantae, has a big smile on her face. I'm reading from the book now. She was staring almost, but not quite into my eyes the way you do on Zoom. "Sarah," she said, "you have to start from the place of being loved and forgiven by God." And as a person of faith, you know, I as a pastor, I had not drawn all those lines between racism and forgiveness and this presence of God, and the way this friend just brought that home so beautifully. You continue, "I was startled. I hadn't expected that. I knew that no individual black person could absolve me or any of us of our sins." And you end this little paragraph, This face, her face became for me the face of Christ. "You are forgiven," not by her, not by, you know, the systems of institutional racism in the United States that are like, no, you're fine, but by Jesus. And that thread is woven throughout this book, this deep, deep thread of faith. I want to go back for a moment. How did you discover your family's connection to Jacob Vanderpool?
So I first heard of Jacob Vanderpool, and it just, as I describe in the book, it just kind of jumped out at me. And I was talking to someone who read the book recently, and she said, it's like it's like the book is the story of what happens when the Holy Spirit speaks and someone is listening. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what it was. It was like God was just speaking to me and I heard things, not a whole voice, but just like something would grab my attention and I would go, I need to pay more attention to that. So I, Jacob Vanderpool's name, his story kind of jumped out at me. And I did some research on it. I wanted to find out more, but I wasn't sure if it was my story to tell. And then I was just taking a walk in Oregon City. I live right around the corner from Oregon City now. And I was taking a walk in Oregon City and I looked and saw my grandmother's maiden name on one of the houses, like, you know, one of those historical plaques. And I was like, wait a second, like, do I have relatives who've lived here? And so I asked my aunts, you know, my grandmother's not with us anymore, but my aunt, she's like, oh yeah, you know, they all lived in Oregon City. I'm like, I had no idea. And so then looking for their stories as well as for Jacob Vanderpool's story gave me a way into the story that I realized it wasn't just lifting this black man out of history and saying like, I'm going to tell that story now, but realizing, no, I actually am connected to this story as well. This is my story too. And yeah, so I found out that, Ezra Fisher, who's in my family line, was a pastor who lived in Oregon City at the time. And then I found out through kind of a deep dive in Ancestry.com that Theophilus Magruder, the man who pressed charges against Jacob Vanderpool, also is a relative of mine. I had no idea when I started researching Jacob Vanderpool that that it was my story too. Mm.
Yeah. What was it like for you as those layers kind of peeled back and unfolded?
Well, it helped me to put myself in history. I think particularly as white people, I often want to distance myself from some of the abhorrent things that white people have done in our nation's history. You know, like those people who were standing around at the lynching mobs, or the people who were enslavers, or the people who were yelling at the, you know, the little black children on their way into school or whatever it is. Like, I want to think like I have nothing to do with that. And looking at this one historical story and realizing that I am related to two different people on both sides of my family, one from my mother's side, one from my father's side, who are both present and involved in this story, it helped me realize I am not, I'm not just an individual person unrelated to all the history that's come before. My family has been here in this country for a long time. And that means that in one way or another, and of course, I don't know all the ways, but all the things that have happened are, they're part, I'm part of the story. Just placing myself in the story and saying, okay, I didn't do those things. You know, I did my own things that I try to confess and talk about in the book, but you know, I didn't do those things in the past. I may not be responsible for them, but they're the things that my community, my people have done. How can I begin to take responsibility for these things? Esau McCulley says, everybody's auntie was an abolitionist, but nobody owned slaves. Mm-hmm. And just that observation that we're so ready to claim the people in our lives, in our family, who we think have done good things. And we really want to distance ourselves from the people who have done things that are not so good. And what would it look like if we just began to say, yeah, those people who did those bad things, they're my people too. And I need to grapple with what to do about that.
And What do you say about taking responsibility? How do we do that? We look back in our family tree and we realize, ooh, it's not all good guys and gals. You know, it is, I think, pretty difficult to be a white person in this country and not have some connection to evil of some kind. And, you know, that might be exploiting workers at the shirt waste plant in the 1910s. Mm-hmm. That might take any variety of paths. But I think, you know, we're recording this in December and I'm deep in Fleming Rutledge's book about Advent. And she talks about taking a fearless inventory of the darkness, and everyone's singing Christmas carols and it's so festive, but she's like, look into your soul. And so when we look back in our family tree and realize, oh, this is part of me, this blood runs in my veins, people who did terrible things, how do you advise people to take responsibility? Because I think that the gut reaction for people is absolute denial, total shutdown, or perseverate in shame, and neither one of those moves us in a positive direction. What do you tell people to do?
Well, some of it is what we've already been talking about. You know, I love that you read that passage from the book where Shantae says you have to start from the place of forgiveness. I think that's absolutely true. Or you can't look because it is too much. You have to deny or stay stuck in shame if you don't have the love of God. The love of God, the forgiveness of Jesus, is, to my mind, the only thing that can set us free to walk forward into a place of, okay, now what are we going to do? And so starting there, like knowing that we're loved, I think it's so... Our culture really doesn't know how to hold those two things together, right? Like, we think either you're loved, that means everything about you is fine, or you're a terrible person, you cannot possibly be worthy of love. So to hold those two things together, I'm loved, and knowing that, I can begin to, as you said, take an inventory of the darkness. So starting with being loved, and then... yeah, just being willing to look at our own hearts and being willing to look at the past. You know, I wrote this book about this one incident in Oregon City in 1851, but every place has a story. Every state, every city, every church, every group, every family, like... there's a past history of injustice and harm, no matter which, you know, slice you want to take. So asking those questions, who has been harmed here? And then I think that if we hold those two things, we are loved, what has happened? I do think it's the Holy Spirit who will open creative paths toward what the next step is. Mm. I mean, I think about, there's a little town on the coast of Oregon called Waldport, and it's just a drive-through town. You know, Highway 101 goes up and down the coast, and most people, you know, they're headed to Seaside or Tillamook or, you know, one of those towns, and Waldport's really not a destination. But the town of Waldport had this street in their town, or it was a, I guess, street is like a downtown type word, is a road out in the country, right? It was Darkey Creek Road. And just recently, in the last few years, the citizens of Waldport said, all right, we need to ask ourselves why this road is called this. What's the story here? And of course, it was named after a person, Lewis Southworth, who had been brought to Oregon as an enslaved person. He had bought his own freedom. Oregon wasn't supposed to be a slave state, but there were people who were enslaved here. So he bought his freedom. He moved to Waldport and he played the fiddle, and he wanted to play the fiddle in the church. And they said no. So he went out and he played the fiddle in the fields. So they uncovered this history, and then they said, all right, we have to change the name of the road. And so now it's called Lewis Southworth Road. And so that's a very tangible, I love this story because it's such a tangible local thing that only they could do. You know, only the citizens of this little tiny town on the coast of Oregon could uncover this history and take this tangible step of just renaming the road sign. And they also collected some money and they had a, they commissioned a statue and they put it out in a park and it's of him playing his fiddle. And so, you know, I can't sit here and say, like, I know what every person on the planet should do about their own history of racial injustice. But I think that once we open ourselves to look at what our specific local history is, then steps like that might open themselves to us.
I so appreciate that nuance. I think we so often want a prescription, and you're pushing us kind of into a reckoning and into a reflection and into that deep inner work that God calls all of us to on every issue we face. And then to, like you said, listen to the Holy Spirit and that prompting of, okay, this one's for you to make right. You and your community, you and your church, you and your town, because we can't all do everything, but we can all do something. And like you said, it's often so local and so specific. And no matter where you live, there are those pain points that if you start to dig, there's a story there. And you unpack this story so beautifully and so faithfully. I mean, I know it's your first book, but it reads like it's your 20th book. It's just so well written. Lead us to the book's conclusion. Where do you find yourself in these final pages? You and your family, your husband got a Lilly Grant, you took a trip. Mm-hmm. Where did that trip take you physically and also emotionally, spiritually?
Yeah, it was really a remarkable thing. We got to go. So, you know, when you write the grant proposal, you outline all these things you're going to do. And then we found out we got the grant and it was like, oh, now we have to do them. That sounds a little exhausting.
What have we signed up for? Oh, goodness.
Right. But we did it and it was wonderful. So we have four kids. We got to take all four kids to Cameroon in West Africa and then to Scotland and then to the heart of America, to a reservation in South Dakota, Pine Ridge Reservation. And my husband's vision for that sabbatical trip was church on the margins. So we worshiped with a congregation of refugees in Cameroon. Just the most incredible, I mean, so much joy in that little dirt floor, you know, corrugated tin roof, little shack. And we, everybody was on their feet dancing, and our family had been sat in plastic lawn chairs up in the front. And so we're just sitting there, you know, our awkward, like Western white selves, like watching them dance. And we're like, you know, I have three sons and my husband, they were all like, no, we're not dancing. And my daughter and I were sitting next to each other and we whispered and we're like, should we do it? Like, yeah, let's do it. So my daughter and I stand up to dance. And this woman dances over. She's like so excited to see us dance. And she dances over and she presses a you know, like the equivalent of a dollar bill on our foreheads. And she's just like so happy that we're dancing. She just has to give us money. And it was such a awkward moment because we're like, wait, like, we're not supposed to be taking money from you. But we asked our guide, you know, what should we do with this? Should we like give it to the offering plate? He was like, no, that would be so rude. Like, you have to keep it. So I still have as a bookmark in my Bible, this, you know, little like Cameroonian dollar that this woman pressed on my forehead when I stood up to dance. Anyway, to go from there to first London and to see the Westminster Abbey. And of course it's so gorgeous. And all the statues of all the famous British people. And of course, England didn't colonize Cameroon. It was the French who colonized Cameroon. But still, to go from the place that had been colonized to the place of the colonizers, just right like that, was really a sense of whiplash. And like, wow, all these buildings are beautiful and amazing, but can I really, it just hits different. It hits different. And so then we went and we went to church at Westminster Abbey, and such a different feel to the church. I mean, it's full of tourists. They're like, they're not supposed to be on their phones, but they're kind of like sneaking their phones out and trying to take pictures. And the priests are like looking around, you know, trying to tisk tisk the people who have their phones out. I mean, it's just such a different feel. And, yeah, it was wild. And anyway, and then we went up to Scotland, did some things, and then in on the Pine Ridge Reservation, my husband is his mom is a registered member of the Lakota tribe, but he is not, because it's, you know, like dilute enough that he's not eligible for that status. But but his great-great-grandfather was one of the first Presbyterian Lakota pastors on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And so we were able to find the church that his great-great-grandfather had founded. And there was hardly anybody in it. It was just us and the pastor and this one little old lady and a couple other people. But my husband... the pastor invited my husband to say what we were doing there. And so he did. And this little old lady says, "I remember your people. I can see your people standing right behind you." And that too, just to see ourselves as part of that story, which, you know, my husband will say like, "Oh, I'm not Native American. I'm white." And he is, I mean, he's white, but this is part of his heritage too. And to see ourselves as connected to that story, yeah, it was really a phenomenal trip. Mm.
I was hoping you would share that story. That story brought me to tears. The "I can see your people," yeah, "they're standing right behind you," because in so many ways that encapsulates the whole spirit of the book, is for good or for ill, these are the people we have come from, and they have done beautiful and terrible things, right? That I think all the time of that Buechner line, that "this is the world, beautiful and terrible things will happen. Do not be afraid." And your book is this story of, okay, don't be afraid, stare it down, face it, work through it, be honest about it, and do things differently in this generation. Like, as far as it depends on you, work for justice, work for hope, work for goodness. It is such a beautiful story. I'll link to it in the show notes. Everyone needs a copy of this book. And I want us to bring it back around to birds, because Jacob Vanderpool actually chose a bird for something very important in his life. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
He did. Yeah. So we don't have a picture of Jacob Vanderpool. I have pictures of all these other guys in the book. We don't have a picture of him. We don't have any of his, you know, letters or journals or anything. All we have is this little newspaper ad that he put in the newspaper for his boarding house and saloon. And, you know, it's this 1851 newspaper. So you can picture the newspaper person like choosing the letters one at a time and sticking them in the machine. You know, I don't know how it works, but he chose one image to go at the top of that ad, and he chose a bird. And then when my daughter, so my daughter's high school was putting a new mural up, last year, and they wanted it to be all these famous Oregonians. And she tells the art teacher, you know, "Oh, my mom's writing a book." And so he emails me, and I'm like, "Yeah, you should put Jacob Vanderpool in the mural." "Well, what did he look like?" "Well, I don't know." So my daughter ended up painting this little bird into the mural, in Gladstone High School. And at the moment, or, you know, plans are underway eventually, hopefully, to memorialize Jacob Vanderpool in some other way. But at the moment, that little bird painted on the wall in Gladstone High School is the only memorial to Jacob Vanderpool that exists that I know. Mm. So.
We have to ask, what kind of bird did she choose?
Okay, so see, I'm not a birder, so I don't know. But she copied the one that's in the ad, and to me it looks like some kind of a duck or a loon. Mm. It's got a very long bill and white spots. I mean, I don't know if you remember, it's on page 151. What kind of bird does that look like to you?
Oh, See, I'm not that familiar with the birds of Oregon, but that looks to me like it's a willet or a dowitcher. It's a wading bird for sure.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, see, I should have asked you before I wrote the book.
it's one of my only superpowers.
That's awesome. A willet or a dowager.
I will look up and I will follow up with you later to see which one hangs out in Oregon. Because, yeah, like you said, it's an old image, but it's got the spots mm-hmm. and the long bill. And it's mm-hmm. yeah, it's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing, Sarah. Well, I'm going to bring us around to our final two questions. I don't know which one is mm-hmm. harder for people. So I'll start with the one that I suspect is easier for you as a birder adjacent. What's your favorite bird?
So I think when you sent out the form, I said bald eagle only because because as I said, we have bald eagles that nest just right over here. And bald eagles are my husband's favorite bird. And so actually when we were deciding whether or not to move to Oregon, when he was in the interview process for this, he's a pastor. So when he was in the interview process for this call, he was out praying about this and he saw up in the sky, two bald eagles. And one of them went and like sat down. That doesn't seem like a bird word, but roosted, sat down, whatever. Stopped flying. And the other one flew off. And he had this feeling that it was like he could either stay or go. And either path was going to be okay. And either path was going to be blessed by God. And we ended up going. We ended up coming here to Oregon. But I'm going to jump in on my husband's answer and say bald eagles.
I respect it. I respect yeah. they are fierce and mighty. I saw a video yeah. recently of one that got caught in a flooded area in this fast moving stream, and this boat came over to rescue it. And you know, you rarely see them up close, but they've got this eagle in a towel and the talons are sticking out, and I'm like, these are brave souls, man. I would want to rescue that eagle, but I'd be afraid it would just gnaw my face off. They dried it yeah. off, set it free, all was well. But whew, bald eagle.
Yeah.
Majestic yeah. for sure. I think it was Benjamin Franklin, who thought our national bird should be the turkey, and I'm glad he lost.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to imagine, would we be eating bald eagles for Thanksgiving? I mean,
who knows? Who knows? Yeah. Turkeys are a little easier to catch. yeah. I like turkeys too. I just don't think they're quite as dignified. Yeah. All right, Sarah. So your book is about all of these hard, brutal, difficult things, but it's also about hope. Where are you finding hope these days?
Yeah. So it's interesting that you're asking that we're doing this right now, because I'm feeling a little bit less hopeful these days than I was when the book first came out, because, you know, the book came out and I had all these, you know, just dreams that everyone in the world would stop what they were doing and say like, oh, a book has come out, and, you know, like lives would be changed. And
the end of racism as we know it. You did it.
Right.
You
did it. Like this one book is just like, boom, it's done. And that has not happened. And in fact, there have been some challenges. The book has not sold as well as the publisher hoped. And I had a speaking engagement recently that did not go well, and I felt kind of rattled by that, and so I can feel in myself I've sunk into this place of like, oh, you know, I don't know if I'm just not feeling the same level of buoyancy that I was feeling right when it first came out. But I think that there's something to be said about that, right? Because hope isn't the same as just feeling great. hope is a long game. And if I think about like Jacob Vanderpool, he was 30 years old when he lived in Oregon City and got kicked out. And he went back to New York. He drove a horse-drawn taxi cab in New York City with his son. And then 20 years later, He came back west. He really wanted to be on the West Coast. This time he went to California. And right before he died, he was able to register to vote. Mm. And so there's something about that, like playing the long game, that you could be totally defeated, totally humiliated, like brought to a court, told that you're not allowed to be there, sent back to the other side of the country, which was, you know, not easy to get back and forth. But then 20 years later to say, no, I still want to do this, and to be allowed to register to vote. And so just to be reminded in myself, like I wrote this book very much as a person who is not an expert in racial justice. I mean, I knew that I wanted to write a book where I hoped that people who weren't already like out there moving and shaking could see themselves in my story. But that means that then I've sort of like launched myself into this space where I'm like, okay, now I've written this book and I'm talking about it, but I actually sometimes feel like I just don't know what I'm talking about and I don't know what I'm doing. But to realize like, okay, that's okay. Like I'm still playing the long game and I'm still learning, and the awkward foot in my mouth things didn't all happen before the book came out. Like they're still happening, you know? And I'm still learning. And that's, I think that God plays the long game. You know, here we are in Advent. Look at those early, like, I love the messianic prophecy that comes in Numbers, you know, like so long before. And the people had to just hold those for so long. And then now we're waiting for Jesus's second coming. And you read Paul, he really seemed to think that Jesus was just about to come back, you know, like, don't get married. Don't do anything. You know, like the time is short, and it's like, it doesn't feel very short, but God is very patient, and God is doing some really mysterious things that are unfolding over a really long time. And so it's okay to have time periods where we don't feel full of optimism. Hope isn't really about that. It's about holding on to the vision, even when you don't feel like it. And just watching to see what happens.
That is a word. That is a word. I can tell you spend some time in the pews.
Oh, yes. I've heard some sermons. I've preached a couple, but I've heard a lot.
Well, Sarah, thank you so, so much. Thank you for the gift of your time, but also just thank you for writing this book, for the courage and the honesty and the gift of sharing your story. I will link to all of your socials and things in the show notes. Friends, if you want to get in touch with Sarah, she's on social media. And also I'll link to her beautiful book, The Place We Make, Breaking the Legacy of Legalized Hate. It is a great book. I know we're past the holiday season, but you always need to buy gifts for people, right? Birthdays are coming. That's a great book to give to those in your life who are beginning to think about these things, friends in Oregon or friends anywhere. Sarah, anything we didn't ask you that you'd like our listeners to know?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because it's just occurring to me that I skipped over the Scotland part of the sabbatical trip. But what we did in Scotland that I need to tell you is we got to go, I don't have the words, but we got to put the leather gloves on and have the falcons land on our hands.
That is a good day.
So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
That is amazing. Yeah. That's on my bucket list.
Oh yeah. It was a fabulous day. I got some great videos of my kids, you know, just like you think you're prepared for it, but then it happens and you know, it's pretty majestic.
You don't know how strong a bird of prey is until it's actually on your arm.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I'm slowly, you know, somebody's making a birder out of me.
We believe in you, Sarah. There's always hope. There's always hope.
Thanks for letting me come on and use my limited language to talk about birds.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah.
The Thing with Feathers is produced by me, Courtney Ellis. Many thanks to Del Belcher for the music, to Todd Peterson for the name inspiration, and to Emily Dickinson for the beautiful poem and for being in the public domain. Until next time, my friends, keep looking up.
What does it go in your soul?
Yes, it does.